Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with custom knife maker Denny Fury of Fury Urban Combat Knives Unlimited. I met Denny in Texas at the Texas Custom Knife Show, but realized quickly that I had seen his work before in Tactical Gentleman's magazines. He makes and designs a broad range of knives, but with his military, law enforcement, and martial arts background, his real bread and butter are the knives that range from combat to self-defense. Though we talked a good while about his knives, we ended up sharing a unique and, to me, thrilling experience with one of the guests of honor there. We'll talk about that and the experience that we shared there. And then, of course, Fury Urban Combat Knives. But first, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell and download us where you listen to podcasts. If you want to help support the show, you can do so by going to theknifejunkie.com/Patreon. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
Ever strop a knife again, even though it gets no real use? Face up to what you are. You're a knife junkie.
Hey, Denny, welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's very good to see you. Like I said, we met at the Texas Custom Knife Show. I spent a good deal of time, kind of came back to your table quite a few times. You had some of the most tactical knives there, and that's really the kind of stuff I'm interested in, combat knives, etc. And then we learned we had a few things in common. Let me just say it was a thrill working out with Doug Markaita and doing that Kali jam.
It was pretty fun. When he hit me up about it prior to the show, I was like, I wasn't expecting it, because I mean, I've done Kali and I've done some stuff with him before, and then he's got another guy that was in there with us, Lee Davis, who lives down here by me, and I finally get in and get a little bit of Markaita Kali stuff into my background. And it was just great getting up there and having all our different backgrounds and being able to see how we flow with each other when we got in there. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah, it was. It was really fun. And it was an honor, of course, to meet him for me. I'd never met him before, and to do some of that like flow work or attack me and I'll show you what I can do kind of stuff. It was so much fun, but it was also really cool meeting you and the other guys. Like you mentioned, the gentleman who's down there in Texas, an old student of his. But that's kind of a microcosm of the whole knife world. Being down there and or being at Blade Show and being surrounded by knives, it's what guys like us love. Where did this love come from for you?
Well, early on, I mean, I actually grew up in upstate New York and grew up hunting. So, you know, at a young age, dad handed you a knife and, you know, with your gun, and we went out hunting. So, and I loved having a pocket knife or, you know, the balisongs, you know, all the stuff normal kids like as far as when it came to sharp objects. And then once I started on my path in the martial arts, I started off in Taekwondo early on at like 7, but then I found Kenpo, and my instructor had a bunch of other backgrounds he encompassed into it. And as you got into your higher belts, he started implementing edge weapons. And for the path I wanted to go on with the military and law enforcement, it really struck a nerve with me, and I became like enthralled with learning all I could about it. And I think that's what's kept feeding me over the years. And when I retired from law enforcement in 2015, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. As far as we moved down to Texas, we were up in Oklahoma, and my wife's company's down here, and she took promotion. We moved down here. And a buddy of mine said, you know, with all your background and edge weapons and everything, why don't you try making knives? And I was like, I laughed. I was like, yeah, I'm not real good with my hands. I said, I can't even hang drywall straight. So eventually we got down here, discussed with my wife, and you know, I started off on a section of my garage with a 1x30. I bought a heat treat oven right off the bat and started just you know, diving headlong into learning the process and everything. And apparently I just had a knack for it. And I mean, it took off. I mean, I've been making knives now for going on 9 years and full time for eight of that. The first year was just, you know, trying to get everything down. I mean, you know, my first few blades look like polished turds. But as I started getting in more and more involved with it, it just doors opened. I like, you know, the stuff with you meeting Doug. I got to meet him early on with him and Jay Nielsen and Dave Baker and all them. And they still keep trying to get me to go on Forged in the Fire. I'm just, I don't have any urge to go on TV. But, it tickles me that I'm where I'm at and able to do what I do and love what I do. And on top of that, you know, I keep adding to my knife collection. That's never stopped even making. I've got a huge collection, that my wife doesn't particularly care for, but.
You know, it's funny. I frequently hear, well, I sold my entire knife collection to start making knives. And that's always like very admirable to me, but it's also sad. I mean, me personally, like to me, I look at it as future currency. You know, when civilization collapses, it's a good trading object. So I got to keep collecting, baby. What I was going to say, you talked about Kempo karate. That was, before we started rolling, I told you that was the martial art that I took in Philadelphia at a place called Martial Posture in Old Town Philadelphia way back in the 90s, early 90s. And it was awesome. I fell in love with martial arts through that place. They had a sort of unorthodox approach to it. I thought that was great. Sort of a Bruce Lee sort of approach to it.
Oh, yeah.
But when I was there training, I became aware of Gil Hibben and the Kempo knife, the two yes. Kempo knives. There were two, and they were both very cool. Did that have any influence on you when you first started making?
Well, the Kempo I started off in, I started off in Shaolin Kempo because we're from the Northeast. So, you know, you had Velaris and you had Ed Parker and all that, and all Nick Sirio. I mean, it was all encompassed and same. And my instructor studied from both Parker system and from Velaris. So I got a taste. But we started off mostly in the Velari system. But then when you started getting in your intermediate belts, you started getting thrown in the Parker stuff. And that's when I first came across, you know, Gil Hibben's, Kempo knife. And I'm like, I love it. Cause it's a modified fighting Bowie with Quinlan's on it, you know, for trapping and catching and stuff. And I loved it. And, I think with that, a lot of my blades, like my hidden tang ones, encompass that type of stuff. And it goes back to, like, you know, the HEMA type fighting where you're using like broadswords and things like that, but you're using it to trap blades and break the other blade and then continue your attack. And it really led into the stuff that I saw in Gil's knife for being used in martial arts and then even in the military aspect.
You're talking HEMA. You know, people talk about, you know, the Quillians and the guards on fixed blade knives and, kind of scoff at, and I'm one of those guys, kind of scoff at the guard being used to trap blades, because it's kind of taking a different, kind of fighting, sword fighting, and scaling it down. But to me, I always thought what was more realistic is using those Quillians to trap more like in, you know, trap your opponent's wrists or arms, that kind of thing. And, more readily than the blade. But to me, all of that, I love, like the Bill Bagwell stuff. You know, the trapping. Okay. So people, can have some idea what we're talking about. Show us a couple of knives. So we can get into it, see what you got.
And going into that also, cause like I'll show you like, the production versions and my custom versions of two of the blades that I currently use, and the use of like jimping and the way you space out things on the blades. Like this is a production version of my Cockaretta's ring dagger.
Yeah.
And it's made so you have the thumb ramp, you know, just like for, you know, keeping your hand there. But if you have it in reverse grip, you also have that to catch and trap the hand, pull it in and do your trapping. you know, and then you can also flay and go in to your extensions. Like I said, this is a production model of a blade that I had been making for a while. And I was approached by the company Combative Edge.
Oh, yeah.
And they deal in, you know, in fighting knives and in military style weapons and all that. And they fell in love with that model. And this is a custom version. I mean, they're relatively same, just different materials and all that. And I use mine are just a little thicker stock than what they use for their productions. And then the other one they had picked up was this one actually started off as I thought it would be like a novelty type blade. And, it's called the Unmai, and it was based off of Japanese kiridashi, you know, just for cutting leather and paper. But it wound up, put a ring on it, and it does the same thing. And I mean, I wind up with a lot of, military and law enforcement guys getting this for like a quick defense knife in their kits. Because I mean, it's made for just pulling out and getting somebody off you quick with a nice quick stab. And the same thing with this one is, real deep, jimping on the back.
For trapping.
And you know, I do a variety of points. This is a custom model. I use different, but I'll put checkering on top to add a little bit more bite, for that type of, technique and stuff when you're using it.
So, for people who are just listening, we're talking about, the jimping on the, well, where the thumb ramp would be, basically. But when held in reverse grip and kind of pinched against the forearm, you can use that little triangle in there to grab someone's wrist, an opponent's wrist, in a quick kind of half beat sort of move. You can't really hold on to it for too long, but it's just it's called trapping. And I see those knives and they get me real excited for a number of reasons. I love a well-aligned ring on a knife, because there are so many poorly aligned rings or just rings that maybe aren't there necessarily for a fist grip. Maybe they're there just for retention when you're not using it, like a bird and trout knife, but that's not a tactical plating kind of thing.
But you're talking like something like a kunai type deal where it's perfectly linear in the handle. So when you're gripping it, your fingers line up with the handle, but the rest of your fingers are offset to a point where it's uncomfortable.
Right. It's almost for turning sideways in the hand and putting your thumb through.
As reinforcement.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, Combative Edge, you mentioned, I can't remember the gentleman's name who, runs that company, but I have his M1 folder from, that was his very first.
Yes.
And it's such a great knife. I love that thing. And that was made by Lion Steel. When I got it, I'm not sure if they're still making it, but
no, he actually has, because the plus side, the reason why I went with them is I wanted to keep everything USA made when it came to any type of production stuff. Wow. And his manufacturing guy is actually a small shop in Dallas, Texas. It was a plus side that, you know, everything is right here in the state for me to be able to get, you know, back and forth with this guy. And where we're prototyping and everything else, when I sent him my AutoCAD for him to get me copies back to see if everything lined up correctly, everything was measured out right. So it was great to have them. And, but he's doing all that now. And like you mentioned, the M1, he just came out with an auto version.
Yeah. The new, this is the V2. Yeah. I don't mean to nerd out, but
no.
I always wanted that auto version and I slept on it. And I just recently saw that he kind of, did some tweaks, some design tweaks. And I love that. I love when companies update models, but keep the same models around.
Yeah.
Tell me about how Fury's Urban Combat Knives Unlimited, like, what's your model? Are you the kind of company that keeps the same models around and you add to it, perfect it, or? Tell me how that works, your catalog.
When I first started off, I mean, it was a plethora. I tried to throw myself in as deep as I could and try a bunch of different styles. When it came down to it, a lot of it and a lot of this, and like when Doug came to one of the shows, one of the other Texas Customs shows, him and I have been friends while he came over and wanted to see my Karambits, because with me being in law enforcement, I always had a Krambit on me on my gun side behind my pistol because it's one of those quick access weapons for weapon retention. When, like, in, you know, when we were doing our little demo there at the last show, that's one of the things I showed was weapon retention, techniques using a knife, having your knife placed behind your sidearm. And my forte has become the ring blades. I love ring blades just for the retention, for being able to escalate and de-escalate force going from a firearm without having to drop your knife. You can resheath it and know where to index it, and have all that. But I mean, I go through, and when I started off, I wanted to primarily, just from my background, I wanted to like mainstream in with the military and the first responder groups. And, right off the bat, I mean, it was rough going. It's for any knife maker starting off. It's going to be tough until you get your name out there. But the plus side for me is most of my college degrees were in business. So marketing was right up my, you know, in my wheelhouse. So I just started saturating marketing my stuff once I had it to the point where, you know, it'd be something I want to put out and that is, you know, somebody's going to come back and say, this looks like, you know, crap. I wanted to get knives into people's hands and have them, you know, test them, check the ergonomics, use them and show that they take a beating and then get back with me. And that way, you know, I'm putting out a product that, people are going to want to buy. And with that being said, I started most of my business after, before I even had a website or doing it on Facebook, on LinkedIn. And just because I had like 10,000 contacts already on there just from the military and law enforcement private sector. And the plus side with this is I got approached by, Kung Lee, the MMA fighter and actor. And I wound up making knives for him and one for a film that it's in hiatus right now due to COVID. But I made him a specific knife for his, one of his movies. And then I got hooked up with the Air Force TACP Special Forces. And I have an annual contract with them now for their new recruits going down range. And I have a specific model that's made for them, that, gets issued to their guys when they graduate from their school.
Well, describe it. I'm not sure if you can show it, but describe it.
Yeah, I don't have one on me, but it's a modified, Western Tanto. Now, the difference with this is instead of having, you know, a Western Tanto has a defined flat front with another edge that goes off, mine comes out is more rounded. So you can do, it's easier to sharpen and the point is more acute for puncture. However, it's also made with, 3/16 inch, steel. So they can use it in the field. It can be worn on kit. It's sharp to use in combat and for any other uses they have. Wish I had thought about it. I mean, I've got, some uncut, blanks downstairs because my military orders due right now for this coming year. And I just started with them, but, and they're made with removable OD green scale so they can break them down and clean them. They're Cerakoted and all that. And they're about 9 inches overall with a 4.5 inch blade, with a deep front finger choil and finger guard. So there's no slipping forward on the blade in any type of emergency situation.
Danny, how did you get a military contract for your knives and what's the pressure like in getting that kind of order out?
It started off, I did 14 years in the Air Force in security police and security forces. I'll date myself. I was active duty from 89 to 93. I was in Desert Shield, Storm, Provide Comfort. And then after 9/11 went back in and went in the reserves. So I was doing that in, you know, at the same time I was in civilian law enforcement. So a lot of my contacts in LinkedIn were, military guys and everything else. And I just happened to have a CEO of a, it's kind of an NGO, but it's called, MVR simulations. And what they do is they do all the airstrike, simulation stuff for the JTAC TACPs. which are basically your tactical forward air controllers, which call in airstrikes and stuff. They embed with the SEALs and Green Berets and all that and go downrange. And he had seen the model that I originally did of this blade was actually huge. I mean, I made it for another guy that had ordered something in a Western Panto, but with, you know, without the real distinct front and all that. And it was like a 14 inch blade overall. And he was like, I'd like something like this for them. He said, but smaller. So I just redesigned it and made the finger guard, come back a little bit just below the edge line and, played with the width of the blade. So it wasn't so wide when you shrunk it down that it looked, you know, just useless. Right. And, he had me do a couple test blades for him and send them in. And next thing I know is a couple weeks later, he's like, can you make me 10? I'm like, okay. So I did 10 the first year, and each year it's gone up. I'm doing, 25 blades this year, and I'm not going to say that because I'm getting, they're charging me government, they're paying me government price. So it's a pretty good contract. But the thing is like I had their class graduates in, annually, late summer. So July, August. And, I start, I get all my stuff in order because before I was doing them all by hand, but now when I order my steel, I do all my steel through New Jersey Steel Baron up there in the Northeast and they water jet. So all I did is I did out my CAD, sent it to them. They water jet my blanks for me. I get them all set. And starting last year, I had a guy here in my guild, the CNC of my Carta. So I had him start cutting my handles out. So I can knock them all out quicker and have them done way ahead of time for them to get there. They can pick out the recipients, get them all set and all that. So, I mean, before when I was doing everything by hand, oh yeah, it was crunch time because I was, you know, covering commissions, cause I my books come open, sporadically and I'm not the kind of guy that will get you on the books. And you're going to be on the books for 2 years. I will not have anybody on my books more than 4 months. So I don't take a bunch at once. As soon as I open the spots up, they're gone. Right. And I get there done and then I open them again and all that. So, but these guys have been a blessing. I mean, every year it's like they want more and more. And I haven't had a complaint from them. They're guys. I'm constantly getting, I've had some of their TACB guys that got the knives call me or email me and say, can you make me some more of these? Just for like their family and stuff. I'm like, yeah, not a problem.
Well, what are the technical requirements? Do they need something for, is this survival if the plane goes down or are they?
Well, these guys, they're already on the ground, but they are, I mean, they're jump certified. So, I mean, they can use it as a shoot knife. Cause it's, I mean, I put a lanyard hole in it and everything else, the whole nine yards, like any other knife, like any other like bushcraft knife that, you know, somebody would take out. The only difference with it being 316, I do a real deep hollow grind on it.
Okay.
However, it's not to a 0 degree apex. I keep it down to about two degrees. So there's still an edge on it, but it's not going to roll on them. Right. And they can still beat the crap out of it, you know, if they have to do something survival wise out there, but it'll also hold up if they have to take it hand to hand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's made for that ergonomic.
Nice. Yeah. That slashiness of the hollow grind.
If you could scroll down, I think I got, there's some blank ones come up, like, right here. Keep going. And underneath the important announcement, that one right there. You just went past it. Yeah. If you look at the picture and you'll see the one just below the important announcement, that's the model.
Oh man. The middle left, right?
Oh yes. Yes. Yeah. The left.
Yeah. That is.
No. Up higher. The next one above it. Yeah, the next one above it. That one. Yep.
Wow. Oh, that is sweet. Yeah, I see the hollow grind. I could see how this could be a very useful blade all around. That front part, you know, though, there really is a secondary tip there, but you have a half the blade is a belly up front, and then you have that nice straight.
Oh, yeah. But even that where you see the tie-in at the bottom of the front of the edge, once I put an edge on it, it's gone because it'll take it completely off and it rolls into it. So
oh, I see.
You can easily, you can roll it right back when you're running it on a strop or on a stone it'll be one smooth transition.
But that front portion is flat, right? For penetration.
Oh no, it's got a belly. It's got a slight belly on it, but I made it like that instead of having it being completely flat.
I'm sorry.
Like the original weapon panels.
I mean the bevel grind on the front
portion. Oh no, it's convex.
Okay. All right. Oh, sweet. Yeah. Oh man, this thing, it also looks like it's set up for a double edge, if you wanted it to be, you know.
Oh yeah. The top can be, I take that down and it's just barely off where if somebody wanted to, they could put an edge on it. I probably think it's 0.055.
So when you heat treat a knife like that, for that purpose, for those guys, are you going for toughness like a camp knife, or are you going for like high edge retention, or like what are your considerations there?
With these, I mean, I use ADCR V2 on these. So, I mean, because it's an all around high carbon, but it also has a little bit more of the toughness because of the chromium and the vanadium in it and all that. So these things, I heat treat them up, and when they come out of quench, they're sitting at about 60, 61. And I take them back to anywhere between 58, 59 HRC. That way you have a good solid edge on it. It's not going to chip. And because of how beefy it is at the top, I mean, you're going to have to really, you know, beat the hell out of something with it in order to break that blade. So it's going to take a beating. And I temper it for two full cycles. So it brings it down. So it's not like super brittle, okay, all the way around.
So, okay, we know that there are some special military guys who get your knives. What about your other customers? Who are the kind of people who go for your knives?
I'd get everything from hunters to your regular EDC carriers, collectors. Cause I do high end stuff too. Like, let's see this one here. I mean, I think you saw this the last show. This is, I haven't sold it yet, but you get something like this one with, you know, it's got the turquoise. It's got, the African blackwood. It's hard to see out here, but you can see it's got the polished hamon in it.
Oh yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. And I mean, I do blades like that. So I'll do, you know, like this one's got custom leather. And then like your EDC style blades that are cheap, subpar, you know, under 200, like something like this, a little 8-inch blade, still pokey stabby, yeah, but it's got like the dual jipping up here. So yeah, you know, yeah, it's
put
good.
Put that up close, please. I want to see that. Okay. I remember this knife. I remember these knives. You had some of these.
Yes.
Look at the, I love that, jimping up front. So you can really, push down, really get some pressure with that. And that swedge almost looks zero ground. That's gonna stick in.
Yeah. And same, I do a lot of these because, you know, it depends on the state where they go. And I get people that go, can you make that with a dual edge? Most cases, I can just put an edge on it for them right then before I ship it off to them.
Nice. Well, I want to find out about, your law enforcement past, mm-hmm, and how that differed from maybe your military in terms of how you were using knives and how you, how they worked into your system and then what you thought a good knife was.
Oh yeah. Military. I mean, when we first got, issued our blades and stuff like that in the military, it was usually like an M9 bayonet. But then like you could carry whatever you wanted on your kit. Because the career field when I went into it originally wasn't just law enforcement and security. We did everything. The Air Force cops were the grunts. I mean, because when we went through our training, we wound up going to what they call Air Base Ground Defense, which is basically Army AIT. And mine was in Fort Dix, New Jersey. So right after we did all our weapons training and all that, we went there. And then after that, you had to go through all your, you know, if you went ERT, which is, you know, the emergency response team, Air Force called it EST. But you still had those aspects. Transitioning and going into civilian law enforcement when I got out wasn't too much of a stretch. I mean, it's like being in Oklahoma, you had to learn, you know, their penal code, their laws and all that. And of course, ROEs are completely different between military and civilian. But for me,
What are ROEs? Sorry, I don't know.
Rules of engagement.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we're not going to frag somebody on the street. right. But like when I started, I started off basic patrolman, and I worked all the way up through. I was a chief of police when I retired. My last 10 years were in SWAT, and I was also a SWAT instructor. So I had all that, and I actually sat on what in Oklahoma, it's called the Council of Law Enforcement Education and Training. And I sat on what they called the Curriculum Action Board when they first started it back in this was early 2000s, and basically we would write and do all the curriculum for specific, you know, schools and stuff like that. We would do. And I rewrote, back then SWAT training and all that and put on classes. And I implemented, because of my edged weapons training, I implemented that into my SWAT training. Now, like, it's different too between SWAT and your basic patrolman. Most departments are going to have some kind, if you're allowed to carry a knife, are going to have some kind of policy and procedure on it, what it can be used for, what it can't be used for and all that. Some departments, I mean, you can use it to cut a seatbelt. That's about it. You can't use it for anything else. Department I was with, it could be used. It fell in the use of force continuum. So if I used it, you know, and I went to stab somebody, it's considered deadly force. I mean, you had to go through a use of force hearing. You had to fill out a use of force form and put it in your report and all that, just like using a firearm.
I was going to say that, you say just like using a firearm, but to a jury to the average person, it seems much more grievous.
From personal experience, it's more personal. It's not like, I mean, cause like from a distance, when I have to shoot a suspect. Okay. And I wind up in an officer involved shooting. There's a mental aspect you got to deal with and everything else, but it's more disconnected. When you're fighting for your life and somebody's on top of you and everything else and you can't pull your gun or you don't want to because they can get a hold of it and you go to a blade, it's close. It's more personal. And the thing is that because I've had experiences with that, and when I go to teach this, and like when I first started teaching law enforcement guys and even military guys that haven't, you know, that were in, not in like combat, you know, career fields, just doing the techniques and I'm like showing them where to actually, you know, strike. I mean, cause you've done the Cali stuff and all that, you know, sticking a knife into somebody's armpit or going into the brachial artery. So I mean, they're like, they cringe and it's like, you know, it's something. Yeah. It's not going to be pleasant. It's going to be messy and it's going to be personal. And the thing is too, and you know, especially if it winds up on the other hand where you don't have one in your hand, you're having to fight for your life against somebody with it. I mean, the fight is completely different as well. So, I mean, when it comes down to, a blade use in a use of force compared to a firearm use. Yeah. It's night and day, when you put it in an aspect of how it feels and how you have to deal with it.
Well, how did you incorporate it, into SWAT training? And I don't necessarily need specifics, but was it a part of the hand-to-hand bit of the training?
Yes.
And you just kind of put the knife in there?
Yes. Because, I mean, the thing is, a lot of times when you're going in, you're going to have some kind of edged weapon on your kit someplace, whether it be for something in close range and all that. Unlike in the military, you know, you'll have an affixed bayonet. You know, in SWAT, you go through a door, and I have my primary firearm, my rifle. And more than likely, the first thing I do, if I turn the corner and I have to engage somebody close range and I can't tell if they're armed or not, I can't just shoot them. So most, you know, in a lot of cases, I'll muzzle thump them and knock them back. Now, if I knock them back and they still don't have a gun on them, but they're still coming at me, I may have to do something else. For me, I'll go to a blade. Cause I know where, for me, I can articulate in my training, you know, if I have to write a report, I knew where to stick the guy or what I needed to do to get them off. And this is where like the training, when I implemented in there, that these officers, once they were trained, can do that and articulate it in a report. Because when it comes down to it, like I'll even teach, when I teach civilians, edge weapons, you have to sit there and I tell them, you have to understand you're standing in a, you know, your 3 foot little bubble around you, your personal space. Is it worth your, I mean, you're going to be put in handcuffs, even in self-defense, you're going to be put in handcuffs. You're probably going to go to jail and get booked in. You're going to go through court and all that, you know, in a lot of cases where, and then it'll be deemed self-defense. But the thing is, it's a lot of headache to go through. So is getting it down there and articulating that, you know, I was in fear of my life, but to an aspect where that I knew I could control the situation instead of discharging my firearm or so on, that I could, the guy was reaching for my firearm. I went and I did a lateral cut to the outside of the muscle on his arm, causing a psychological injury where he looks down, he sees he's bleeding, he stops, that type of stuff.
A lot of people, well, I get comments from time to time, when talking about, the effectiveness of knives as a self-defense weapon or as a weapon at all. I mean, obviously we know it's great as a murder weapon. But you'll hear people, oh, I would just use my gun. Don't bring a knife to a gunfight. And yes, all those things are true. But you mentioned escalation of force. You mentioned a continuum of force and yes. that there are things change and, you know, physical confrontation is dynamic and, you can't tell where it's going to go and to rule out not. So what I'm hearing from you, an experienced military and law enforcement officer, is that people really do use knives in even when guns are involved.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I've seen situations where, you know, where I go to an assault, and I get there, and you know, we get the stories from the parties and everything else. One guy, I mean, I had one, and this was probably, and I was a patrolman at the time. And what it was a basic assault at a party. We got there and apparently two parties got into it. One brandished a weapon, firearm. The other guy thought he was going to go for the gun. So he pulled a knife and stuck the dude in the arm. Well, I mean, honestly, it would work. I mean, and of course, I mean, you go down, we went through the case and sat through it and listened to, you know, testimony of that. He wound up getting off on self-defense just because, you know, brandishing a weapon in that manner as a threat. It could be considered an escalation of force. I mean, because like when law enforcement or anybody, your first level of force is verbal, okay, and then physical motion or hands on, like where I have to put my hand on you to back you off. Then I go into pain compliance with my hands. Next would be impact weapons or less than lethal taser, things like that. But the thing is, when you look at this, even going knife and firearm, all that, even the taser can be a lethal weapon. You hit the wrong person with it, it could kill them.
Yeah, they hit the floor, hit their head.
That, or not only that, somebody's got an arrhythmia. You've seen it. It's no joke. We've seen it happen in videos is, you know, you pepper spray a guy and then you hit him with the taser and they ignite. Because of the alcohol in it. Yeah. Yeah. Catch their clothes on fire. And yeah, guy winds up with burns. I mean, it happens, but some of this stuff is unforeseeable. I mean, you're not going to know. You go out on somebody and, you know, you're not going to know if they have a heart issue. You know, if the guy's all hyped up and, you know, you got to tase him, you're not going to know that less than lethal may kill. But, you know, when it comes down to like blades and all that, I mean, you're walking a fine line of an appropriate use of force and deadly force. If you don't know what you're using it for. And that's where when it comes down to, you know, the things you were saying about people saying, you know, don't bring a knife to a gunfight or I'll just use my gun. You know, in some situations, if you don't have the training, I wouldn't pull a blade and I wouldn't use it.
Yeah. I mean, you would say that in probably most cases or many cases. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's your only choice and it's your only option, And your life is in danger. Yeah, go for it. But it is really easy, for someone who's trained to take, well, I shouldn't say that. I should not say it's really easy to take a knife from someone, but if you can be overpowered, I've been overpowered before just in training. I've been overpowered and thought like my skills were superior, but I was still overpowered, you know? So it can happen to anyone.
And that's what I mean. Like the thing I said, like, that's why, like, when we did the thing with Doug, my whole thing was using the knife as a, weapon retention, implement. So, you know, I'm doing it to protect my firearm. So if somebody, cause a lot of times you get a drunk suspect or a suspect that just doesn't care. He goes for your firearm. You know, you may have a triple retention holster on, but what if he breaks it loose? That or an incident that I had with a guy wound up on top of me, outweighing me by 150 pounds. You know, I don't want to pull my gun out, drop it, still have to fight with this guy. And while I'm trying to hold on to this guy for dear life, he gets a hold of my gun and kills me. You know, I'll take the chance of dropping my knife, because then if he gets that and I feel myself get stuck with that, I know it's do or die time. I'm taking the pistol out, you know, but that's like I said, we're talking about like different aspects. We're talking about a level of training that most people don't have.
Okay, so we were talking about ring knives, and I know that that's your forte or something that you love and that you put a lot of trust in. And I'm also presuming a lot of people in law enforcement and military like them also for their retention and for the ease of deployment. You know, grab that ring. One of the knives, one of my daily fixed blade knives that I carry is a ringed knife by, it's the Night Stalker by TKL. And I love how easily it's drawn.
I see it.
But I can't help but think of what some people have said. And this, this one person in particular comes from experience, people that they've seen is degloving, that horrible term, where, where it pulls the skin and muscle off your finger. Have you seen any of that out there, or any concerns about that?
Not with an appropriate size ring. I mean, now I've seen a lot of times with degloving. That's why, like, a lot of guys in law enforcement or first responders don't wear wedding rings. Mm-hmm. Something that's on there tight that's going to catch, you're going to wind up. That is a real issue. The thing is, if I pull something like this, you're going to have to twist this thing really well. And more than likely, it'll break my finger if you get a, but you're going to be grabbing a hold of the blade to twist it like this. If it's an appropriate sized hole, and usually mine are anywhere from, 1 1/8 to 1 3/16. So you can wear it with a glove on or it's just, but it has enough that it's not sloppy and you're going to lose control of it. But that risk of actually, you know, stripping your finger and winding up with an avulsion where you pull the skin right off your finger, it's highly unlikely in something like this, especially with properly made ones. I mean, I think with the TKL one you're talking about, I mean, it's almost comfort fitted on the inside. It's rounded.
Yeah.
It's smooth. Yeah. So, and if it's the proper size and all that, I don't think that's a true risk when it comes to something like this. A broken finger is more than likely. And that's why one thing I tell, like when I'm teaching this and people want the ring blades, this is one thing. Okay. This finger is really strong. I don't like this.
Not a big fan.
No, because that finger is one of the weakest ones on the hand. And that one, I mean, it's not going to take much just from the angle. So that's why, I mean, if you're going to carry it like that, make it so your hand's on the outside of it. But yeah, I don't really condone that, because it's bad enough boxing and all that. Right. You can box all your life and you're still going to wind up with boxer's fractures. On that side of your hand.
A lot of karambits out there don't have the appropriate alignment, or they have too small. The holes are too small. I couldn't imagine it with gloves. Your point about the hole diameter is a good one. Yeah, I always, like I said, I went through a brief period of time where I was like, oh, no more ringed things. And then and I was like, wait a second, I love them. So have you seen in the past 10 years a infusion of karambits into the everyday market, like into the gas station knife and people thinking they're the ultimate weapon?
Yeah. And the thing is, like, and you might, because you can go on YouTube all day, you'll see these guys bashing them for them. And yeah, I mean, and the thing is, when it comes down to it, is training them. I mean, even Doug will tell you, I mean, if you don't know how to use one, I wouldn't be sitting there flipping them around and everything else. People get them for being flashy. It's almost like the Balisong movement where, you got sport flippers. I mean, and that's fine. But like, you get in the street and you pull out, like, this is one of my go-tos that I carry all the time. This is a Crudeau. It's perfectly aligned in my hand. I still make a fist. It's got good size on it.
Nice.
But I'm not going to sit here and flip it around, because the thing is, you wind up, if you start doing it wrong, it comes back and you embed that thing in your wrist. Flails and extensions, I mean, that's a different story, because you're using it to strike with the top of the blade, that, or you're using it as an extension to do your draw cut. But I'm not going to sit there and be flipping it all around and everything else and doing it for show, like, you know, like a Balisong knife.
Yeah, yeah.
But you do see people doing it.
The flails, yeah, you do. The flails could be tricky with a folding karambit, I think.
Yes.
It might fold, but the pulls and the things on the other side. What do you think of Pakal style knives?
I like Pakal too. I've got a similar version, that the one here, this daily EDC one that I showed you.
Yeah.
I actually have one where it's flipped over in reverse grip.
Oh, nice.
I have a Pakal version of it. But yeah, I like those too, just because if somebody's more apt to constantly carry in reverse grip, instead of having to do the unorthodox where you have, you know, the way here where you're having to hold it like this instead.
Right.
It feels unnatural having it on this side, because it's just not fitting in your hand right, where it would be this way and having the blade, you know, on that side drawn that way. But I mean, teach his own. I mean, I still do it sometimes like this. But if I reverse grip it, I like having it like this, because most times it's a get off me move, just to get somebody off.
So, in terms of, where you see the knife market around you, where do you see the place for fixed blade knives and custom and combat and self-defense knives? Are they growing in popularity? Are they, I know EDC is a real big thing, small folders stuff,
yeah.
But it just in terms of the kind of knives you make.
Yeah. I do custom folders too, but that's like, I do them limited because I do everything by hand on manual mills. And like you were talking about, the funny things you were talking about, the karambits, you know, doing doing flails with them. Most of the ones I make are lockbacks. So that way it stops that from happening. And that's like, I've got a model that I make for karambit.com, and they have it on there, and I do that quite a bit. But, since I've found my niche in the market doing it and all that, I stay booked, and I'm constantly selling my stuff out. Like from the last show when you saw me, I had three knives, and they were three of my high end ones, but I sold them when I got back, and I have two left, and I have, and they're either like, and then I like daggers and things of that nature. But I mean, and the old style, like, this is more of an English style handle, but I like doing the Fairbairn style leather handles and stuff like that. Those are classics, and people are constantly going to them anyways, just because they like having it's a piece of history, even though it may not be an original. It's something that was carried by, you know, guys in World War I, World War II.
Yeah. And the daggers don't go out of style. They will always, they will always be here. I remember, at the show you had something, it wasn't this buoy that he's going by. But it was reminiscent of a kind of a K bar, if I remember correctly, with a big fuller in the side, clip point. It had a sort of combat look, like an old school, but sort of modernized, and I saw a guy buying it, and I was so jealous.
Yeah. And this is one I just made for the show, and it's something I used to do a lot of, and I just got back into them, but, the trench knives.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, this has got carbon fiber and B10, but I really like the old trench knives and everything. And I mean, I did a couple like old 1918s. I'd really like to be able to like do my own my own brass ones and do all that. But I don't like to smelt and do all that other stuff. So
let's see that.
I'll do these full thing.
I've been watching this come together on Instagram, this last batch. And this is cool. I like the finger break in the center.
Yeah. And I usually, sometimes I'll do it all the way across and I'll have it all the way, but I've done different ones like that, or I'll just have like almost like a finger. The first one will have a finger ring and these will all be open. But yeah. And I've done the classic where they're all just coming through.
That is sweet. So how do you choose the blade for something like that? Cause I'm always thinking it's got to have a back edge, because of course, when you use that knife, you're going to come up behind someone and cut their throat like an old movie.
Well, they have the ones where there's your dagger style, like the old 1918s and things like that. And I've done those too. These ones here, I mean, the thing is, even if you're going to cut their throat with it or anything else, you probably punch them in the back of the head first.
Yeah.
It's going to be ringing. Then you can just take it, do whatever you want to, and just turn around. But yeah, I mean, I've done every type of version using a blade. I've done a clip point, like a Bowie style. This one, I just did it because I started doing a bunch of the military order ones, and I figured, why not do the same blade style on the front of this one? And like the top of this is super thin too. So if somebody wanted to, an edge could be put on it.
So what are the knives like when you make stuff, you basically have indicated that you have books, but they're not too far out because you don't want people lingering. But it also seems just like from your Instagram feed that you produce stuff and you also make it available.
Yes.
What is the kind of stuff that you find goes quickest? Is it what you imagine it will be or what?
Sometimes some of the weirdest crap I make sells. Cause like I'll honestly, you know, I'll be doing orders or making stuff for shows and I'll have scrap left. Right. And I try to make use of everything, whether it's forging Damascus or if it's a piece that has a unique shape, I'll make it into, see if I got, cause I had saved a picture. Cause I thought something like this would pop up. Yes. But I made this thing out of a scrap and it sold like, let's see if you can hopefully pick this up in the.
Oh yeah.
It's a scrap piece and it's got like an arrowhead point. It's dual edged and everything, but it's like a quick, you know, a quick little neck knife, but it's stuff like that. Like you're thinking, that's going to be around for a while. And it's like one of the first things to go here. So, you know. I mean, I have pretty much everything, like the shows I make, and I've been doing it pretty much every show now, is I'll make it available. Because I'll have people constantly while I'm building these things ask me, you know, well, how can I get that? Well, so I used to say, you know, you need to come to the show, but, you know, there's people living halfway across the country and they can't make it. So what I usually do now is I'll open up online sales for the stuff on the table at the same time. And that's why, I mean, like the last show, I had four pieces left. And my wife's always going, you're making too much. And I wind up selling it. She goes, oh, okay. And I'm like, yeah, I told you it's going to sell. And, it, you know, I get back and it's like some things, like the one he was showing on there, that survival knife, I forgot to take it down. I saw that's gone. And I mean, that styled after, it was a dagger style, but it's styled after the old, you know, the old ones we had growing up in the 1980s.
Yeah. With the compass.
Had the little compass on the back. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, the tang was that big and it would break.
Yeah.
That's a through tang. It goes all the way to the end and it's got a thread rod. So that bolt pulls on, pulls the blade in. But you open that thing up, there's a ferro rod in there. There's fishing line, all that stuff. Cause I'll take it to the lathe and the handle's made of 7072 aluminum. And I'll put all that stuff in there. You have all the stuff you had when you were a kid, except that thing's not going to break on you.
That is cool. I did not realize that. I thought the handle looked a little long. I was like, what's going on with the handle?
Yeah.
And that makes sense. That knife, I think you and I are the same age, judging yep. from your email address. And that knife was a huge part of my, adolescence. It was the closest thing I could get to a Rambo knife. until I got a Fury, actually, a Fury survival knife. I don't know if you remember that company from way back then.
Yeah. Cause I remember when I got my first one and they ordered it, had to have dad get it, but you ordered it out of a comic book.
Yeah.
And I got one of them that came in a cheap leather sheet with the little sharpening stone in the front pouch. And then, you had the little water filled compass on it. And I was like, I always wanted to make something that's going to stand up to it. And I've done three of those, some of the sawbacks on them and everything. And yeah, those are another ones that I think I'll hang on to for a while. They're gone. And it's usually the nostalgic guys like us that wind up buying them.
Yeah. It's like, I always wanted one that's good. And finally someone's making one. Denny, but before I let you go here, and I hope you're free for another 10 minutes, on the other side, do an interview, little extra bit that we can give to Patreon members. Okay. That'd be great. And I'll ask you some other stuff there. But here I want to ask you in general, what are your impressions of running a small, or what is your experience in running a small business in knives in this day and age? And what advice would you give someone who's embarking on that?
Well, when I started, luckily I had a couple guys. I mean, nobody was local, but I had a couple good mentors, and I honestly never thought I'd be doing this. And sitting here now, having this interview with you is like being where I'm at. But the thing is, if you have the drive and you really want to do something like this, don't just jump into it and go willy nilly. I mean, the thing is, just do as much, research and studying. And that's why, I mean, before I even started selling my stuff to general public, most of the stuff that I sold were to friends, military buddies. One of my troops and then one of my supervisors have my first two knives. They're always wanting, he goes, you want this back? I'm like, no, I want you to have it. I want you to hang on to it. I was like, cause I don't want to look at it again. it's horrifying, but, you get all these guys. And the thing is, I've talked to Doug about this too. And even to Jay is like, a lot of people see it's been a godsend and a devil, portion fire. It's made all these people think they can be knife makers just going, I can do what they're doing. You're seeing a portion of what they do and they go out and try it and they burn their house down. Hmm. That or you're not using the right steel and you're constantly seeing this in these groups. And my thing is like, I got into a guild where everybody helps everybody. It's great. And once I got in, some of these guys that I go to shows with now, they're like, when we first saw the stuff you were making, we didn't think you were going to make it. He goes, but you stuck with it. He goes, I said, that's the whole thing. And then I constantly, once you guys start telling me, it was great when guys, I don't mind people coming up and telling me, even being an ass about it and telling me that looks like crap. Even now, if it looks like crap to somebody, I'll take into consideration, get their feedback and see if it needs to be refined. That's like you were talking about, making blades and stuff. And do you constantly, I'm constantly redrawing stuff or redoing it in CAD and making tweaks on it. I'll look back at it and say, now I'll pick it up and I'll feel like it doesn't feel right and try something different with it. But the thing is that with these new guys coming out is find somebody you can mentor under. Honestly, I mean, now I constantly got guys now asking me to teach classes. I just don't have the space or the ability to do it, but I'll mentor them. I mean, guys in the guild, I've got a guy now, and this kid, he threw himself into it heart and soul, and he listened to everything I told him. I'm like, look, I said, and I told him, just don't get advice from me. I said, you got master smiths in our group. I said, talk to them too and get their feedback. And and you're going to get, you're going to talk to 50 different people. You're going to get 50 different ways to do something. But you may take a portion of each thing that you've heard from them and make it your way. And it's going to come out the way you want it. And it's going to come out the way your customer likes it. And it's the thing is you, if you're that passionate about it, you got to keep learning. And it's the same thing I do. I like teaching like martial arts, law enforcement, or even, and I, the thing is the day and it same true today is I've only been doing this 8 years and I'm friends with guys like Gil Hibben or Stanley Busbeck and stuff. These guys have been making for 30 years and they'll constantly say, I'm still learning today. And the thing is, the day you think you've learned it all, pack it up. Because, you know, first of all, your ego is getting involved. And second of all, you're wrong, because there's always more to learn. Always. And that's the whole thing is just, I mean, it's everything is a learning concept, a learning progression. And I mean, if it wasn't the case for me, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you, because I wouldn't have seen you at a show. I wouldn't have been doing the stuff I've been doing. I wouldn't be actually making a living off of it. I mean, cause you hear all the knife makers going, how do you become a millionaire as a knife maker? Start off with $2 million. Yeah. You'll be down to $1 million in the first year. Yeah. And that's the whole thing is like, but the thing is, it's all about learning your audience. Like we just discussed is like, you know, I do a lot of everything, hunting knives, kitchen knives, all that. But my main group that I make for that are constantly hitting me up are the military and the first responders, you know, and the self-defense martial arts aspect of it.
Well, there it is. Denny Fury, thank you so much. A Fury Urban Combat Knives Unlimited. Thank you very much, sir. It was awesome to catch up with you and find out about your company and your career in knives. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's great to keep catching up with you. It was great to meet you and hope to see you again.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too.
Want to start a podcast? You'll need podcast hosting. TheKnifeJunkie.com/podhost.
If you search Google for the best knife podcast, the answer is The Knife Junkie Podcast.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Denny Fury of Fury's Urban Combat Knives Unlimited. Do check him out on Instagram and also go to his website. He's got a great website with beautiful photography of a ton of knives that he's made. And I know a lot of people here have similar taste in knives and fixed blade knives and fighting self-defense knives. And it's a treat. Go do yourself a favor and check out his work. All right. Be sure to join us on Wednesday for the midweek supplemental, Thursday for Thursday Night Knives, live 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. For Jim, working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying until next time, don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram, and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487, and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.